there's plenty of negativity in the world. So at Advice Column, we share uplifting reminders and tools to connect with the best in yourself, others, and the world. Welcome, friends. I'm Lisa Liguori, and today I'm here with Brad Tunis, panelist and friend, to talk about addiction. So we've had a chance to cover any number of topics as a panel, and I've been wanting to get to this one, Brad, because I know you have experience working with people who are struggling with it. I feel like I struggle with many different types of addiction, and I think it's more common than we realize. So thanks for being willing to share.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here with you, as always.
Yeah, so I think traditionally when people think of addiction, we think about, I don't know, heroin or something, which is a very powerful chemical compound, but there's addictive behaviors. I mean, I was just mentioning before we started that I feel like I'm addicted to work and busyness and feeling like I'm accomplishing something to the point that if I haven't had a productive day, I actually feel uncomfortable or like a withdrawal symptom. Addicted to junk food. I mean, you name it. So I recognize I have these behaviors that aren't serving me well. And maybe a way to start is just to kind of tease out what is the difference between addiction and just something that's not optimal. Does that make sense?
I think addiction, and I've heard it said, is that addiction really kind of becomes a behavior that you continue to do when it's not serving you or it's harming you in some way.
Yeah. That's a great definition. It sparked something. I've also heard addiction is something that we do and it continues to narrow the number of things in our lives we can get joy from. So it becomes like more and more of an obsession for only that one thing at the exclusion of other things being able to fulfill us. Does that make sense?
It becomes a hyper-focus, I think. And, you know, I'm by no means a neuroscientist, but I'm very, very interested in this field for very personal reasons and professional and just hobby and sheer interest. The dopamine, you know, everybody's talking about dopamine. Dr. Anna Lemke wrote a book, great book called The Dopamine Nation, that really talks about how we're all, to your point, sort of moving towards this addictive behavior in almost everything we do. And the phone and social media and these types of things are just sort of leading us closer and closer to that, down that path, because they're designing them to grab our attention in an addictive way. And the dopamine system, and there's, again, brilliant people that talk about this far better than I do, but it's not of an achieving the reward, it's in anticipation of.
So the dopamine comes not when you achieve the thing, but before?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yes. And so when you think about addictive behaviors, it becomes this, we're chasing it, and you're not chasing it as much as you're chasing the anticipation of, where is it? So I'm going to do it some more. And then you chase something that isn't actually even achievable, because the hit you're getting, again, is in the anticipation of not of achieving the reward. An example I like to give people, and I don't know if anybody's ever done a long hike or something, I'm like, we're going to hike to this waterfall, or we're going to go to the top of the mountain.
Yeah.
And maybe it's a long hike. And so a good practice is just, okay, let's get to the first water stop. Let's get to the lunch stop. Mm-hmm. Let's get to this point. And then, you know, you break it down, you chunk it down into achievable levels versus we're going to hike 25 miles today. That sounds daunting.
Overwhelming.
But if we go, we're going to hike 5 miles to our first break, and then we're going to hike another five and have. What people notice when you look back on the hike, getting to the destination was rewarding and nice, but it's not typically what you remember where the stories come from. It's all about the journey. Remember when we made that first stop? Remember that lunch, how good lunch was?
Yeah.
Right. So our focus then becomes these little rewards we get as we're moving to the big thing.
Yeah.
We get to the top of the mountain and we go, yeah, that's nice. And when we look back on it, it was all these things that happened along the way.
It's so interesting that you use that analogy, because I was just thinking this morning about how in my head, I'm always thinking when such and such happens, then I'll feel X, Y, Z, whatever thing I want to feel, proud of myself, happy, contented. And it is an ever-changing goalpost, because as soon as I do that, then I pick the next one. And I don't know how to change that habit, but I want to stop thinking whatever I want, something has to happen first. Like there has to be a condition for to feel that way.
So Dr. Andrew Huberman, of the Huberman Lab podcast, which I think is like the number one podcast in the world, and who this guy single-handedly basically made neuroscience like a rock and roll concert.
Totally.
He talks really beautifully about this and has had people on his podcast that talk about this. And I talk to my clients about this, and it's how, so the idea then is, how do we make effort the reward in and of itself?
Mm-hmm.
How do you slow down and become present for the process, allowing the process to be a reward? Now, you have to pay attention for that to happen. If you mindlessly move through the process trying to achieve the end result, you're kind of bypassing these little hits of, ooh, yay me.
Yeah.
Or whatever it might be along the way. So to me, it becomes a slowing down in making the process the reward in and of itself.
So by slowing down, you automatically do that, or you slow down so you
slow
have
down
a chance?
So you can pay attention and you have a chance.
Okay. All right. So how would that look practically?
If we stick with our hike analogy,
mm-hmm.
celebrating getting to mile 5, stopping, pay attention, yay me, little pat on the back.
Yeah.
Wow, we made it to mile 5. All right.
Mm-hmm.
There's something there, and it's paying attention to that little something that you get, that little dopamine hit, the going out of your way to acknowledging yourself and the work that you've done to get to where you've come. And so now the process of climbing, of doing the 20-mile hike, you're getting this sense of reward throughout. It's not, oh, I'm going to grind this thing out until we get up there and expect the heavens to open up.
Mm-hmm.
No. Celebrate the journey.
Yeah.
And your path along the journey. If it's, I'm on a diet, not focused on, well, when I lose 20 pounds, it's going to be awesome. I lost one. Today, I did my walk. I made it through a meal and I had the salad.
Mm-hmm.
That dopamine hit will also keep pushing you forward. So it in and of itself is the motivating factor to move us forward towards our goals. So we have to make the process in and of itself a bit of a reward.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
I bet kind of turning things into rituals could also help with that. Like I'm thinking, people take pictures of their kids on the first day of school in front of the house or things. But by creating routines or rituals that are kind of special, it's a way of just calling out something. Or I don't know, if you're having a salad, maybe you have somebody I think on this podcast mentioned when she gave up alcohol for January, she would still get a big glass, fill it with ice and put her kombucha in it at night, because that ritual was actually part of what she liked about her drink. But it was kind of like a celebration.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm thinking maybe that's a way to force a slowdown or a celebration at those little milestones.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
I think you can get creative about it. I don't know that there's one way to do it. And I think that's where we get stuck too, with what works for one person may not exactly work for another. So as we talk about these generalities, it's this idea of like, okay, how do I get creative about this idea that it's exciting. For me, you know, I don't know that anyone loves to work out. I do enjoy working out, but there are a lot of other things I could do in a day, but it's imperative to me for many reasons that I work out. Mm-hmm. Well, some days I have a longer workout plan than in other days. I celebrate the section. I break my workout up into sections. So maybe a 90-minute workout, but I may break it up into 15 or 30 minute segments and give a little, hey, me.
Yeah.
Here we go. Feeling better. A little more towards that goal mm-hmm. as a way to not just bail out and go, yeah, I'm going to quit now.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And it's less intimidating.
It's far less intimidating.
How you said that you have a really strong opinion on addiction. What is your opinion? Because I have no idea what you were referencing.
I think as it relates to... So addiction, on some terms, I think, can be seen as distraction.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We're distracting ourselves from life, our emotions, our feelings, things we'd prefer not to deal with, or we don't know that we have the capacity or the strength to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think that's true. I think we're all far more powerful and capable than we give ourselves credit for. And if each of us were to review our lives, we can come up with specific examples. And this is an important part of my part. A job is to help my clients go, I there's no way I'm going to be able to do this. There's so much fear. There's so much resistance there. And I'll say, okay, let's look back at your life and look at some things that you thought you'll never be able to do. And here you are.
Mm-hmm.
It's no different.
Yeah.
It's no different. As it relates to this addiction thing, I'm in recovery for alcohol. And I've worked with a lot of different, I've worked in an addiction center before. I firmly believe that recovery is a process of not just stopping the behavior or the habit, it's spiritual and emotional growth.
Yes.
You have to grow as a human being. Otherwise, you've probably heard the term, or maybe the listeners are familiar with the term dry drunk, but they don't know.
What does that mean?
You're still a jerk. You just stop doing the thing. And you're resentful for it.
I see.
Poor me. Uh-huh. The victim. The victim. And so in my own recovery, it's really, really important for me to reflect on the gift that my addiction brought me.
Wow. Tell me more about that.
The way I see it now is I've got this allergy or disease, or I don't even know what to call it.
Yeah.
A propensity to, once I have one drink, I want 30. That, and that obviously in the end turns things really sour and I'll burn my whole life down slowly. But that I have this thing that I have to be very aware of, and that if I'm not growing spiritually, emotionally, being a better human, living, serving, a constant sense of purpose, those resentments and those feelings and those things that I don't like will drive me back into a bar.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is a requirement that I continue to grow daily.
Wow.
That's the gift.
Yeah.
Because I think my wife or friends or anyone else that knows me will say, you're a far better person and much more pleasant to be around. And I wasn't even the kind of person that did these terrible, god-awful things. I was probably the guy you wanted to party with. Because I wouldn't let the party end. But out the other side of it, and the people closest to me that see me and know me now are like, oh, wow, there you are.
Really?
That's pretty neat. It's funny, too, you get rid of it with the alcohol. You know, you don't even realize how much you're standing or the addictive behavior, the hyper-focus that you brought up earlier is blinding you from everything else in life. And, you know, me, I've always been this, what I thought was a pretty deep spiritual person. I've studied the Dharma and Buddhism and was always, you know, searching the reason. What's the point of it all? What's the reason? The alcohol and the addictive behavior was preventing me from seeing clearly. And now that it's been removed, I'm like, oh, so much more has opened up. It's like, I can see things. I'm experiencing things. I'm not missing the way the breeze hits my face or the way the trees are moving in the wind, or the way my dog acts like a lunatic when I come home and how it touches me in ways, because I was kind of numbed out or hyper-focused to, hey, I don't have time for you, dog. I'm getting to the wine cellar.
Yeah. Don't get in my way.
Don't get in my way. I need this thing.
Yeah.
And so that too is, we've talked about slowing down now a second time, is I think when you manage an addictive behavior, you have to sort of slow down and surrender, and you've got to make some deep, deep fundamental changes in sort of how I think you view the world, and be willing to take on this journey of growth. That's sustainable recovery. Mm-hmm. If you white knuckle it, which I tried, and I can't have this thing, it's not good for me, I know it's not good for me, and that's a bummer, you will never succeed. Because you're just resentful and angry all the time.
It's kind of a matter of time, right? Because you
just a matter of time.
Yeah.
Just a matter of time. And so I think recovery, whatever it is who do I want to be? Who can I be? And it kind of, it starts, the momentum starts to gain because it's tough. It's tough. I tell people, and I won't use the language on the podcast, but you gotta be a tough son of a son of a gun to manage addiction. Mm-hmm. Anybody can fold and go back into their addiction. That's easy, right? And the brain's happy because patterns persist, and the brain's back in its pattern and doesn't care if it's good or bad for you. It's just doing what you do and have always done. So you got to be tough. And eventually that momentum starts to carry because life starts to get beautiful and rich, and things happen in ways that you might never. The thing you were using the addictive behavior for is right in front of you. The addiction standing in your way.
What do you mean by that?
Most people are using, I'm going to go out on a limb and say, most people are using some type of an addiction to avoid, distract, or to gain, to push away what they don't want or hold on to something that the addictive behavior gives them.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But that's impermanent. Yeah. That's fleeting. That is never sustainable. So when you remove that, you're forced to move into, okay, this thing that I want, maybe it's there for me. How do I naturally open and soften to it to move myself in a way towards the thing?
So you're addressing the real issue that's underlies it the whole
time. Yeah, I think addictive behaviors really are a symptom.
Mm-hmm.
They're just a symptom. There's more that needs to be addressed. For me, the way I've kind of, I'm not even 100% sure on this, but to the best of what I've figured out is that anything too high was overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
Anything too low, I just didn't want to deal with. So I preferred comfortably numb.
Yeah.
And alcohol is beautiful to get you comfortably numb.
Yeah.
And I am not waving an anti-alcohol flag here. I don't tell people what they do, and I don't judge people. Everybody's path is everybody's path. That's not my responsibility. And there's a lot of danger in that. And my wife can drink like a normal human being, and she does. And I loved wine, and it's, you know, it's a bummer, but it is what it is. And it's not that big of a bummer because I wouldn't have experienced all the things I'm experiencing now, and I'm not done yet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm just, in a way, just blossoming. I mean, it's because I'm not like 20 years in recovery. I'm not 10 years in recovery. I'm not 5 years in recovery. Mm-hmm. It's a relatively new couple year thing for me that maybe I knew was always there, but finally decided everybody has their own bottom.
Yeah.
Well, and this is true with food or anything else.
Everyone I know who is in recovery, it's interesting because I think a long time ago I would have thought, this is not a group of people who's really enlightened and reflective and dedicated to personal growth, just because I didn't understand. But now that I'm wanting to do work on myself, I see that the people who are the most honest, accountable, growing are people in recovery. And I think it's because it's so difficult to look yourself in the mirror and address the things that are the hardest to see, probably. And so I see the blessing in it that you're talking about.
And I think they say in a lot of programs, I know, and I've dipped my toe in a lot of programs, whether it be Buddhist-based recovery stuff, AA, which is a beautiful program and not usually what people think of it, and that's a shame. In all these programs, they kind of say, you got to keep your side of the street clean. You keep your side of the street clean, you don't have to be looking over your shoulder. You're not worried about what you said to somebody and what you said to somebody else. You go to bed every night with a clear conscience. And in the AA program, one of the things that they encourage you to do, and so do other traditions, have a reflection as I lay in bed each night. I just kind of briefly go through my day and go, could I have done anything better? Do I owe anyone an apology? And I just sort of review my day. And if that's true, well, the very next morning, I make the phone call. I make the apology. I learn from my mistake. Whatever it may be, it's this constant, quick, couple-minute reflection on, okay, all right, here we go. Do better tomorrow.
Yeah. How do you do that? I mean, I'm assuming a forgiveness of yourself process has to happen too, because otherwise you're just taking an account of all the mistakes you make, which might leave you in a bad place. But I mean, I think the accountability is amazing. I don't know why I resist saying I'm sorry. And then once I do, it's like the weight of the world is off my shoulders. I think I need to make it more of a habit. And also I struggle to let things go when I'm mad at myself. So how do you approach those things?
We need to realize that our mistakes and the things that we did, first of all, living in the past is pointless.
Mm-hmm.
It is pointless. And regret's an interesting thing. And there's a new book. I mean, hopefully people are getting some ideas for some new books by Dr. Ellen Langer called The Mindful Body. And she talks a lot about these decision makings and what's a right decision versus a wrong decision, and how do we know it was right versus how do we know it was wrong? We didn't take the other one. Could have been worse. Might have been better. Could have been about the same. You never really know.
Yeah.
The way I view it really is everything that's happened in my life has led me to where I am now. And I'm pretty okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
I wake up in the morning and I'm like, all right, man, you're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll try and do better, right? It's not like there's no destination.
Yeah.
One of the things I tell my clients, and I may have said this in one of our previous conversations, is, well, the good news is there's a path out of this suffering. The bad news is the path never ends.
I like that.
And I mean, the work continues.
Mm-hmm.
Always.
Yeah.
And isn't that maybe the purpose of our life on some level? Mm-hmm. It is an exploration.
Yeah. I like what you're saying too about this, I forget what you called it, but this thing that's kind of a signpost for you of where you, it was a tunnel into growth. Mm-hmm. Where if you didn't have to come up with strategies or explorations to deal with it, you wouldn't have maybe necessarily done that growth. So I related because I get really, really angry. And I was talking to a therapist about it once and he said, yeah, but this is like a, let's say the snow is really deep and you don't know something's down there, but because there's a flag sticking up, you can see it. So these times when you get angry are actually invitations to say, well, what is like a negative emotion is actually a place to have self-curiosity. Like what is going on here? Where if it wasn't there, it'd just all be submerged. So I'm trying, it's really difficult, but to look at it not as a failing when I feel angry, but like, okay, this is a gift because I wouldn't have even known to explore that. I would have probably just kept trucking along and bottling it up.
One of the things that I talk to my clients a lot about, and I do, is when anger arises, anger's interesting. Ask yourself, what am I afraid of? It's a little more approachable because when you're angry, you're just angry because I'm right.
Yeah.
You kind of get this opposite that might not actually be true. You're not seeing it maybe clearly from all the different angles. But when you ask, what am I afraid of? Because anger is typically a manifestation of fear.
Yes.
When you can approach it from that way, it kind of opens things up a little bit more.
Yeah.
I think.
That's a great question.
Just an idea and a tool. Like, what am I afraid of here? Or the other thing I like to do is, what is it about me? So when we get angry, sometimes it's like, well, they did this. Mm-hmm. Well, they, whoever they are, is shining a light on something you probably don't love about yourself. So this is the idea of like, quit blaming. It's like, yeah, quit blaming because there's something in you that's getting triggered or touched.
Mm-hmm.
And what is that? And start the work there.
And that's the part we have control over.
That's the only thing you have, quote unquote, control over.
Yeah.
And you're not going to change anyone else.
Yeah. Despite trying.
Despite trying, which is exhausting.
Totally exhausting, yeah. So what do you think are some great questions that you use when you're talking to yourself? Because I'm guessing it's an entire toolbox that you've developed so that instead of having to numb, you can comfort yourself through something that you would have had to numb before. So what does that process look like in the moment?
There's a quote, and it's a long quote by this guy, Francis Wellner, and it's in it, he says, you know, our existence here is about full-throated living. And I actually looked it up. I was like, full-throated living. I believe I know what that means, but let me see what people say about that. And it is this, you know, your life is fleeting, your life is here, and it's a beautiful life. And part of the beauty is the sadness and the anger and all the emotions. There isn't a good or a bad. We need to stop seeing things as good or bad. And as they are. And the real gift and beauty of being a human being is that, you know, we've got this subconscious and this conscious mind, and we can, it's a beauty and it's a detriment, but for various reasons, but it's an opening to, huh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. I probably say that more than anything else in the last few years. Huh. That's interesting. My wife can make me mad. And for nothing.
Yeah.
And I'll feel it, right? So you slow down and you practice, and this is a practice, and you slow down. And so before you react, and you know, mindfulness is talked a lot about. Mindfulness is the ability to slow down, step back, create a response before you react. We typically just react.
Yep.
slowing down, responding. How do you respond? Pause. Get curious. Get interested. Wow. Anger is starting in my belly. And here it comes. It's growing. And it's warm. This is really interesting. A sense of like playful curiosity.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've taken from some, I've studied the work of Dr. Stephen Gilligan and continue to study his work. And it's a lot of creative mind work and generative trance style work. And it's a lot about visualization. And he pulls from a lot of Eastern philosophies, as well as the work of like Carl Jung and Milton Erickson and some of these other people. But this pause in a playfulness, mm-hmm. a tenderness, and a fierceness. Mm-hmm. And so we have these three archetypes within us and kind of constantly checking in. And I visualize them all on like bar stools that can move, and they need to be level.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're feeling too fierce, maybe we need to bring a little playfulness or tenderness into this.
Yeah.
If we feel like we're getting disrespected, maybe we need to bring a little fierceness in to set some better boundaries.
Yeah.
But it's understanding where these like three basic archetypes are to kind of help you move through the world in a more balanced way. All part of the pause process, right? First, you have to have the ability to take a breath, slow yourself down, and then get curious.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can start adding the tools in. The tools don't work if you're doing them running 100 miles an hour.
Yeah. So many times I've been saying, I should not be sending this text right now. I can't stop myself at the same time. I can stop myself, but I choose not to, I guess. So the discipline, I think, to have the pause is difficult for me.
Because it's a practice. And the other thing that is it relates to addiction or sobriety or whatever it is you're not going to go from 0 to 100. You're not a switch that can go from, well, I'm here, but I want this, and I'm going to flip the switch and get there.
Mm-hmm.
We need to get comfortable realizing that this is a journey.
Yeah.
It's a process. And let's be honest, in my opinion, what else are you doing?
It's very important work.
You have nowhere to go.
Yeah.
Death.
Yeah.
That's all where you're headed.
Yeah.
So slow down. You're not going anywhere. So take the time.
Mm-hmm.
Get curious. And you will build a resiliency and a strength in the mind to do that, but you have to just start leaning into it.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you do screw up and you do send the text or you do holler at the person or whatever it happens, you reflect, an apology if possible, and you do better next time.
Mm-hmm.
You drop the inner critic thing is, and it's been coming up a lot this week with clients in that, the inner critic thing is toxic.
Mm-hmm.
Because the brain and the body don't know what's imagined and what's real.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you talk to yourself in this terrible way, your nervous system is shifting as if somebody else is saying it to you.
Oh. Like you're under threat.
Yeah.
Wow.
And you're putting yourself under threat.
Yeah.
And that's where that sort of tenderness is. And I get it that the whole, you know, people listening might be like, oh, here we go again, hearing about self-love and self-compassion. It is not an easy thing.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started meditating 30 years ago, there's a metta is kind of this sending love and compassion for others. And I'd get up in the morning and I'd go to the Sangha and yay me, it's 7 a.m. on a Saturday and I was probably hungover. I show up and, you know, the teacher's like, okay, we're going to do metta today, loving kindness. And I'm like, oh man, I'm just going to sit here and focus on my breath because it's difficult.
Yeah.
It's difficult. It's something we have to cultivate. But the more you cultivate it, the more I think you realize you truly can't love someone else unless you're okay with who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Like truly.
Yep. I just heard a woman speak, and I'm trying to remember her name, but she's a Berkeley researcher, and she researched on the power of self-compassion and how it's different than self-complacency or empathy, and that performance of athletes even goes up when they practice self-compassion. And that something you said kind of reminded me of it too, because there was the fierce, kind of like the fierce self-compassion, which is sticking up for yourself and kind of the mama bear. And then there was the more gentle, comforting, like a parent might comfort their infant. And she sort of demonstrated the two aspects of self-compassion in a really cool way.
You need it all, right? Mm-hmm. We've got these different aspects of ourselves and our personality. Some learned, some we never wanted, and were kind of thrust upon us from our parents and our earliest experiences. But you have to become aware, acknowledge, soften to, and then you can start to adjust and kind of play with. But I would encourage people that are listening, and if they're taking anything from it, to remember this is a leaning in. It's not going from here to there.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just dip a toe in this thing. And then maybe I'll try two toes. And then maybe I'll get my foot in there. And then I'll get a leg in there. And I don't think it works the other way.
Yeah.
Nor do I think it's sustainable.
It's a kind of unrealistic and unfair expectation.
And then what do? We beat ourselves up about it because we didn't do it.
Yeah. Well, when you're getting curious, I was wondering if you try to name or talk to yourself about what you're feeling. Because I was watching my friend, she's fostering this little boy, and he was having a meltdown, as two-year-olds should do. And she said to him, "You're very frustrated right now. And it's okay that you're frustrated. It's okay when you're frustrated to clench your fists or to say, grr, but it is not okay to bite or to headbutt people." And I'm listening to this conversation, and I was frustrated later that day, and I was thinking to myself, you're a very frustrated CEO right now. But I was wondering, because we talked about Michael Singer earlier. He doesn't, I don't think, in his philosophy, waste time, if you will, even naming things. He just acknowledges that he has a thought and he tries to let it go. Then I've heard other people say, you name it to tame it. So I'm just wondering, because you've become effective in talking yourself through those moments, again, where you might want to numb out and staying with it. Are you having a conversation with yourself, like, why do I feel this way? Or what is it I'm feeling? Or what are you actually saying to yourself in those moments that help you endure it?
So, two things. I think, first of all, the naming thing is very helpful. And I think what we know from the neuroscience and some of the research, and that we need to move things out, mm-hmm. right? They're not good trapped.
Yeah.
And if naming it and owning it allows people to get it out there, I think it's incredibly, incredibly helpful. And I actually think for somebody who's moving into this sort of self-relations style of work on themselves, the just dropping it is really difficult for, like, my clients.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean just drop it? I can't just drop it.
Yeah.
Okay. I can see how that's too far of a stretch. Mm-hmm. Let's name it. Let's put it out into the world. Hey, I'm feeling this way.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, okay. That felt something led up there. That was a release. Now maybe we have a chance to drop it,
mm-hmm.
right? But getting it out, saying it, otherwise we're just repressing it. And when you repress things, they grow two heads and three heads and four heads, and then they become a five-headed monster, and there's getting them nowhere.
Yeah.
And this is where a lot of naming things is really helpful. This is where there's more and more talk about somatic work, which is moving things out. And I've kind of dove into this a little bit with my clients when a client has a particular goal of...
I'm just turning off our timer, sorry.
Has a particular goal to, you know, what do they want to create in their lives? I'll have them say it. We'll come up maybe with a visual representation of it. And then show me what that means to you.
Hmm.
Show me with your hands and your arms. Make a movement. Mm-hmm. If you just had to show me what you want, show it to me. Because thinking about it isn't enough. We need to be able to move it, feel it. And, you know, this is why I think like dance and things like that are so important.
Yeah.
We're moving. You know, there's a, as Dr. Gilligan has said, there's a musicality to our lives. And that subconscious needs to move. It needs to feel. Thinking of it only is a problem.
Yeah.
And it doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah. I was so on the other side of this wall. I was in a meeting and somebody was talking about what direction he wanted to go with his life. And we had things, lists on the whiteboard. And a woman who I think is a very skilled coach said to him, where do you want to walk? Which of these lists do you want to walk toward? And he said, I think, and he started to say, I think, and she's like, I know, but where do you feel like moving toward it? And I thought, oh, how interesting. I've never been asked anything like that. But I think that's to your point about this, that part of ourselves that has something to say too, maybe.
In some of the generative work, will it, you know, we'll actually have clients stand up and, okay, now step to the left. What's a playful representation? And I want you to step into that and literally, physically step to the left.
Yeah.
Okay, step into your representation of fierceness. Step forward. Mm-hmm. So we're literally moving into these things, or we do timeline stuff where, you know, we all have a lineage and things are passed from one generation to the other. And so if maybe you're dealing with a particular problem, you have a client, you know, there's far more to this process, but have them soften, have them settle into the problem, kind of dive into the communication between the conscious and the unconscious, and then step back in as your parents who might have had this problem.
Oh.
How would they have seen it and dealt with it? And then maybe another generation back, how about your parents' parents?
Mm-hmm.
Right? It kind of creates this idea that the we get stuck and that the problem is only mine and it's ever only been mine and no one else has it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, nope, it was actually passed down and everyone. And it just doesn't feel so lonely.
I know, because we're so much far less alone than we think we are.
We are all suffering. And that's, I think that is the number one thing in a powerful statement that I love to use. And again, I may have taken this from one of my teachers or mentors, but me too. Mm-hmm. Me too. All of it.
Mm-hmm.
I work with some brilliant people as clients. I don't know that I've ever worked with somebody that doesn't have some level of imposter syndrome, mm-hmm. or what they call imposter syndrome.
Yep.
I just think it's a thing that we all have.
Yeah.
No matter how successful you are, we all have it.
Mm-hmm.
How did I get here? Do I deserve this? Am I good enough? It's just a part of life. Mm-hmm. Now it becomes, how do you manage it?
Yeah.
Not that you have it. No problem. How do you work with it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we've gone a far.
No, it's,
I could rope this back into addiction somehow.
It's wonderful. I know we do have a hard stop in a couple of minutes. Is there anything that you think people should know just based on your life experience? Maybe a baby step to lean into this type of work, whether it's an big addiction that we're dealing with, or just want to get better at weathering discomfort and staying present during it.
Sure. What is the number one thing I would say? Our rigidity is the problem. You have to be flexible. Mm-hmm. If you're rigid in your stance, rigid in your view, rigid in what you want, rigid in how it should go, you're going to get knocked down.
Mm-hmm.
You have to stay flexible and you have to stay creative. You're the artist of your life and your life is your masterpiece. It's not going to go great all the time. It is your relationship to it. And to build a better relationship to it, you have to stay balanced, centered. You got to, you know, like a skyscraper that can lean into a wind or an earthquake or a storm, but doesn't get knocked down. It's got to be stable and firm, but it's got to have flexibility into it. And I would start there because I don't know that I think you can do anything from a point of rigidity.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. I love that.
And, you know, maybe in a future podcast, we can walk through a short centering practice that might allow people to do that. Before we go, breathing. There's a reason why everybody talks about the breath. It's not the thing. The breath is the thing that shifts and connects to the nervous system in the body. The thing is to bring the breath, grounds you and brings you back. So if you're starting this and you're like, I don't want to wait, I want to start now, breathe. When you find yourself get contracted, mm-hmm. when you find yourself caught up in that conscious, ruminating, thinking mind, take a nice, deep breath and release. Mm-hmm. Step one.
I love the simplicity of that.
We make things too complicated.
Yeah.
It's not that complicated. It really isn't. And that's the beauty of it. It's just not that complicated.
Let's do a couple of breaths right now to wrap up. Would that be okay?
I would love to.
Should we do a certain, is there a certain method we should use for doing it?
We could use what a lot of people have talked about, I think is a nice breath. It's a breath I teach all of my clients. I'll ask everybody just to close their eyes because this is a inward moving. Everything we're talking about is about tapping inside. And we're just going to do a short little in-breath in through the nose, filling the belly, pausing. Another sniff breath in through the nose, and then allowing the breath to drop out of the nose. And on each and every one of those out-breaths, just allowing yourself to soften. So again, one more. And now go create.
That's awesome. Thank you, Brad.
You're very welcome. Thank you. This was fun.
Thank you for spending this time with us. My prayer is that this conversation gives you ideas and inspiration for living the kind of life that is meaningful to you. See you in the next episode.